Shrink Wrap Radio number 376, A Psychodynamic Approach to Personality Structure with Dr. Nancy McWilliams.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with noted psychoanalyst and author Dr. Nancy McWilliams. We'll be speaking about understanding personality structure and its role in psychoanalytic diagnosis and therapy. Nancy McWilliams, who teaches at the Graduate School of Applied and Professional Psychology at Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey, is author of Psychoanalytic Diagnosis, Understanding Personality Structure in the Clinical Process. That was published in 1994 and revised in 2011. She's also the author of Psychoanalytic Case Formulation and Psychoanalytic Psychotherapy, A Practitioner's Guide. And she's also the associate editor of the Psychodynamic Diagnostic Manual. She's past president of the Division of Psychoanalysis of the American Psychological Association and is on the editorial board of Psychoanalytic Psychology. Recipient of many awards, Dr. McWilliams specializes in psychoanalytic psychotherapy and supervision, the relationship between psychodiagnosis and treatment, alternatives to the DSM diagnostic conventions, integration of feminist theory and psychoanalytic knowledge, the application of psychoanalytic understanding to the problems of diverse clinical populations, altruism, narcissism, and trauma and dissociative disorders. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Nancy McWilliams, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you on, which is the result of urging from Philip Brooks, who teaches at the California Institute of Integral Studies and who also is an ardent fan of Shrink Wrap Radio. And he strongly suggested that I have you on the show.
Well, please thank him for me.
Yeah, I will. I wasn't sure if he had any particular connection to you or not. Have you done some teaching out at the California Institute?
Yes, I have been there.
Okay.
An interesting program out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Where are you based?
I'm in Western New Jersey, but I teach at Rutgers University in the Graduate School of Applied and Professional Psychology. So I teach in a PsyD program that prepares therapists.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, I see from your resume that you're also a board-certified psychoanalyst, but also that your BA was in political science. So I'm wondering how you got from poli-sci to psychoanalysis.
Well, it was actually more the other direction. I was always interested in people and in the deeper meanings of why they behaved the way they did and individual differences. And when I went to Oberlin College in the early 60s to be a psych major, you couldn't take their intro course until your sophomore year, and it was a strict two-semester, four-hour course of rat running. And then so it was your junior year before you could talk about people. And in the political science department, they were talking about people from the get-go. So I thought that would be a better general major.
Interesting. I ran into the same thing as an undergraduate myself, thinking I might major in psychology. Turned out it was all about running rats. And the guy started out the semester announcing to the class, if you're here to find out about your own personal quirks and those of your friends, you're in the wrong place. Psychology is the science of animal behavior and humans.
Yeah, that was the party line back then.
Yeah. Thankfully, it's evolved a bit. So
I studied political theory because they were talking about human motivation in political theories. And my junior year, my professor handed me Freud's Civilization and Its Discontents. And said, you know, for your honors thesis, you might be interested in trying to sort of deduce Freud's political theory. And that was the first time I'd ever read anything psychoanalytic, and I was captured.
So the hook was set, so to speak.
Yep.
Now, I think there are many therapists out there who are not trained as psychoanalysts per se, and perhaps who don't even consider themselves as practicing psychoanalytic psychotherapy, but who nevertheless value the psychoanalytic understanding of personality structure. Does that fit with your perception?
Absolutely. That's certainly been my experience.
Mm-hmm. How do you account for the persistence of the psychodynamic understanding of personality?
Well, I think, it's an understanding of personality that tries to make meaning out of things. It doesn't just list traits. It tries to understand what are the central preoccupations of different people. And human beings are meaning makers and meaning seekers. I think it's also intuitively resonant. People respond to psychoanalytic descriptions of personality differences and they have aha experiences. Mm-hmm. It makes sense of friends and of themselves. But I think this isn't really a big part of the answer, but there's a tremendous amount of empirical support for the personality differences that emerged from people closely observing individual differences from a psychoanalytic perspective.
Well, that kind of leads into my next question. Did you have a follow-on thought you wanted to complete there?
Yeah, I was just going to add that it's useful that, you know, even if you are cognitive behavioral in your orientation or you're a substance abuse disorders person, it helps to know something about the personality of the person you're trying to help.
Yeah, I certainly agree. And I certainly have observed over the years that people who are trained in some other modality, for example, Gestalt therapy or maybe CBT, as they got deeper into their practice, they developed a hunger for more depth, for some kind of more complex understanding of people. And so they gravitated towards psychodynamic training of some sort or another.
Yes, yes. I know many people that description applies to.
Yeah. Now, in your recently updated book on psychodynamic diagnoses, you note that many of the psychoanalytic concepts are difficult to pin down empirically. So I'm wondering how that plays with the current interest in the APA, with everything having to be evidence-based.
Well, in APA, there's a group of very influential psychologists who use the term evidence-based in an incredibly narrow way. What they mean is, have there been randomized controlled studies of a particular technique?
Mm-hmm.
And these are the same people who tend to define the psychoanalytic tradition as if it's all about a particular technique. And it's really not. In fact, I don't know of a single psychoanalyst who would say that what defines psychoanalysis is that, you know, we put people on the couch and ask them to free associate, and that should be good for everybody. It's much more a sensibility or a knowledge base. And if you define evidence very narrowly like that, that there have to be randomized controlled trials on the technique that you're studying, it's not very applicable to the psychoanalytic tradition, which is more about listening and listening for uniqueness and for underlying meanings. We don't see ourselves as applying a technique. So although there are randomized controlled trials of some psychoanalytic approaches more narrowly defined, like Kernberg's transference-focused therapy, there aren't a lot of randomized controlled trials of specific psychoanalytic techniques. But what there is a vast literature on personality differences, on neuroscience, on development, on attachment, mm-hmm. on all kinds of areas that bear on what you do as a therapist. I would say my work is always evidence-based, and I don't think any psychoanalytic therapist would say that we should not base our work on evidence. We also tend to base it on supervisor recommendations, on what was helpful to us in our therapy, a clinical anecdote, and so forth. But we do read some empirical literature very assiduously.
Yeah, I was. I've been interviewing some people that are involved in what has been called neuropsychoanalysis. So there are people out there.
I heard a piece of your interview with Jaak Panksepp, who I think has discovered some things of enormous relevance to psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love his research. So again, that's a kind of evidence-based. But there's been an odd development in psychology where a lot of the researchers don't have a clinical practice and don't have much empathy with what it's like to do a clinical practice. Mm-hmm. They're good at running very good research trials of very limited phenomena, and then they get upset that therapists aren't using the outcome of their research to apply to much more complex real-world phenomena. And without the experience of having been therapists themselves, they often treat practicing therapists contemptuously, as if we are not interested in science.
Somehow that's almost reminiscent of the rat-running days that we were talking about earlier.
Yes, I'm afraid so.
Yeah, there is that sort of narrow understanding of science that seems to persist in the field of psychology and particularly in the APA.
Yeah, it's not a majority of APA, I don't think, because actually APA as a total organization put out a press release a little over a year ago saying that what matters in psychotherapy is not so much the particular technique as the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, there's enormous research attesting to that.
Sure.
Something like 85% of the variance in outcome relates not to the particular brand name of the technique, but to the quality of the person of the therapist, to their skill at getting people to talk about themselves, to the relationship. So it's a small group in APA, but it's a very loud group. And they are talking to the media saying these contemporary therapists, they're not reading the important literature, namely their randomized controlled trials.
Well, I actually read in, I think, the most recent American Psychologist, a report by a committee, I guess, that was set up to look at training in psychology, both at the undergraduate and the graduate level, and to try to revamp the whole enterprise. And the word science and evidence-based kept recurring throughout, and it seemed like in that very, very narrow way.
Yes, and when I hear enough of that kind of stuff, I find myself having the fantasy that a whole bunch of therapists should descend upon the academic laboratories and say that we are the ones that should be defining what they do. Because the idea that research scientists should come into clinical training programs and tell us that what we've been doing for decades is all wrong is enormously smug.
Yeah.
At best.
Yeah. And it's also striking because last time I heard, clinical psychologists outnumber the other specialties in the APA. Isn't that the case, that more than 50% are therapists?
I think that's right. But speaking of personality, I think therapists often are of a somewhat depressive psychology themselves, find themselves worrying that maybe anybody who criticizes them is right.
Uh-huh.
You know, a lot of therapists have sort of drunk the Kool-Aid that, gee, maybe I'm doing something wrong. The academics are telling me I should have been able to fix this complex problem in six sessions.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Yeah, I can resonate to that. Now, the DSM-5 has recently come out amidst a fair amount of criticism. What's your own response to DSM-5?
Well, I was very critical even back in 1980 when DSM-3 came out, and I think DSM-5 is sort of it's taken categorical, non-inferential, non-contextual, non-dimensional diagnosis, or the so-called neo-Kreplinian diagnosis, where things are present versus absent, you know, there or not, here are the criteria, to its logical extreme. And finally, there is a reaction against it. To be fair, the DSM was never intended as a guide to clinical practice. It was intended to make it easier for researchers to do a particular kind of research. So it didn't initially identify itself as any kind of Bible of mental health. But when the drug companies started claiming that their drugs alleviated these categorical disorders, then some psychologists began doing experiments, and I'm grateful to them for it, that eventually demonstrated that psychotherapy helps with those disorders as fast as the drugs do. But in the process, they kind of bought into the drug company's preferable definition of the problem. In other words, that these are discrete disorders, that, you know, we don't all have everything, that we're not all vulnerable and so forth.
And, of course, the other major institution or industry that's helping to drive things is the insurance industry and reimbursement. And that certainly has reified the DSM as the ultimate authority.
Yes, it's certainly in their interest to do that. I mean, they marketed their policies to corporations saying that they gave comprehensive mental health services. And as soon as the corporation signed up with them, they kind of said, whoops, we didn't mean the personality disorders. That's not comprehensive mental health service. But we have research showing that more than 50% of people who come for psychotherapy have some kind of personality issue that goes along with their symptomatic issue. So the insurance companies, you know, would like to, I don't think that they're evil people. I think that they're in a system where they're just trying to save as much money as possible.
Right, right.
So it's their interest to see it a certain way.
Yeah. Now, some therapists are skeptical of the whole diagnostic enterprise and wouldn't concern themselves with it at all were it not necessary for insurance reimbursements. So let me put to you the question that you raise in the very first chapter of your book, which is, why diagnose?
Well, I actually think that even therapists who say that they hate diagnosis or don't diagnose, they do diagnose in an intuitive way if they're any good. They get a feel for which kinds of people are more comfortable if you say very little and give them a lot of space versus which kinds of people really want you to be engaged with them and will feel abandoned if you leave too many gaps in the conversation. So I'm actually sympathetic to the idea that the diagnostic categories that are most common now don't tell us very much about what's really important to know about people. But I do think if you think about the term diagnosis in its original Greek meaning, to understand or to know thoroughly, that any good therapist tries to have a feel for his or her patient.
Mm-hmm. An interesting point that you make in this regard is that diagnosis can play a role in the communication of empathy, I guess, to the patient. Tell us about that.
Well, if you pick up that a patient has what in the psychoanalytic literature has been generally referred to as schizoid, or the Jungian literature would say introverted, if you get the sense that you're talking to somebody who has a very sensitive sensorium, is much more comfortable with distance than with closeness, then you might even just be sure you're not leaning over too far into that person's space. And they'll feel it as more empathic if you just give them a lot of room to tell their story. Whereas someone with a more depressive tendency who seeks comfort in closeness and feels easily abandoned is going to be able to tell their story much better and feel you as empathic if you get that about them and draw them out explicitly. The more schizoid person is likely to feel you're impinging on him or her if you try to draw them out. The depressive person might feel you're just not interested if you're not asking questions. And again, I think we do this very intuitively, and I would have done it intuitively and not written a book about it, except that I was trying to train therapists in personality differences, because I think that's the most important thing to know.
Mm-hmm. Now, would you ever tell the patient what the diagnosis is that you have come up with as a way of creating empathy to kind of say, here's what I think is going on with you and here's what we know about this?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I can't imagine not doing that with a person.
Uh-huh.
First of all, if they need a diagnosis for insurance purposes, I generally share with them what the options are that pretty much match what their complaint is, and we make a collaborative decision about how they want it represented, because sometimes it's a kind of close call. Is it dysthymic disorder? Is it major depression? Is it a post-traumatic condition? It might meet all those criteria, and there are different implications of them. I had a paranoid woman once, very early in what was then the peer review process, where there was starting to be insurance company concern that therapies not go on too long. She was paranoid to the core, and I knew that therapy with her would take literally years. And when we were sitting there in the first session, I said to her, well, you know, as you and I can see, what you're talking about goes way back in your history, and it goes very deep, and so I'm going to have to give you a personality disorder diagnosis, because that's at least a diagnosis that your insurance company will be willing to reimburse for a long enough period of time. And knowing that she was paranoid, I didn't want to just drop a diagnosis on her and make her feel like I was humiliating her or attacking her. So I just handed her the DSM and said, here are the known personality disorders that have been accepted by the American Psychiatric Association. Why don't you find the one that feels most like you? And she looked through them and she said, oh, there I am, paranoid personality.
Wow.
Distrustful. And it was a whole different experience when she was collaborating on this.
Oh, I love that story. By the way, feel free to throw in any stories or anecdotes that come to mind. That always enlivens these interviews.
Well, I have a lot of them.
Sorry
you asked.
I'll bet you do. That. No, I don't think I'll be sorry. So what are some of the limits to the utility of diagnosing?
Well, of course, first of all, you can always be wrong. You can go down the wrong path, and I don't think you should ever be confident in your diagnosis. I know Anna Freud said that treatment terminates, but diagnosis goes on forever, because we're always learning unexpected things about people. And people are unique, and none of those categories really capture. Nobody matches up to all
No, that's good. You keep rolling. I was just going to say, you know, going back to the days when I practiced, that was always such a challenge. I mean, people aren't like what's in the textbook or the DSM.
Yeah.
I mean, they're like it, but they don't fit it exactly.
Absolutely. And often the diagnosis doesn't necessarily suggest a particular treatment, too. It's not like medicine, where if you get the diagnosis right, generally there's an agreed-upon treatment for it. Often that's not quite true in psychotherapy, even if you get it right. You know, let's say you just diagnose someone with a substance use disorder. You don't know right away whether they're going to be responsive to detox and rehab and AA, or whether they should go into another kind of program, or whether you're going to have to work with them a while till you get them motivated to do that. So, you know, I think it's important for understanding, but it's very limited in terms of what it means you can do, at least right away.
In your book, you also refer to what you call the fringe benefits of diagnosing. What is it that you have in mind there?
Well, in my own experience, and there are a couple of exceptions to this, but in general, people really appreciate feeling listened to with an effort not to try to match them to a prototype in the DSM, but an interest in really understanding what it's like to be them. I think also if you really get what your patient struggles with in a deep way, you get realistic. You and the patient get realistic about what is acceptable. I mean, is what they're complaining about, for example, let's take a really shy person. who wants to be the belle of the ball. You know, if you really get a feel that their shyness is part of a deep temperamental sensitivity and tendency toward withdrawing, you can kind of reframe things together as, you know, like, I don't think you're ever going to be the belle of the ball, but I do think that together we can help you use your sensitivity to better advantage and not be so withdrawing in social situations. Or let's just specifically, you wanted examples. If you're diagnosed with bulimia in the DSM, it doesn't give you very much. I mean, there's a huge difference between the college freshman or first year who comes to the college counseling center saying, you know, I began putting on weight because this is a new environment. I'm starting to purge. I'm worried about it. I think I should talk to somebody. That's a completely different kind of clinical experience from someone who gets pulled to the college counseling center kicking and screaming because her roommates heard her vomiting in the bathroom, and they think she has a problem, and she sits there in front of you and says, I don't get what I'm here for. This is not really a problem. This is how my mother taught me to control my weight. I've been doing it since I was 7. What's your problem?
Wow.
You know? They will meet exactly the same DSM criteria for bulimia.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
The first one you can probably help in a few sessions, and the second one may take a year and a half before she separates enough from the craziness in her family of origin to see that she has a problem at all.
Uh-huh. Yeah. You say there's been a tilt from classical Freudian drive theory toward a more developmental point of view. Take us through the highlights of that, if you will. It's kind of a huge question, I know, but
yeah, it's really huge. Well, Freud was trying to make a grand theory based on drive, and he came up with originally, you know, the erotic libidinal drives. He tried to base everything on that, and then he was so struck by what happened in World War One and in some of the disappointments in his life that he decided that aggression and, you know, the death drive were as important as the life drive. And, you know, that's I kind of love grand theories, but it doesn't help you much with what any person's individual story is. And over the course of his career, he changed his theory a lot, and he became very interested in, you know, the relationship and the specifics of the person's early experiences and how those replayed in the therapy. And subsequent analysts sort of took it from there. People like Erickson looked at the first 6 years as Freud had, but also the whole lifespan and talked about what was going on developmentally. People like Rene Spitz noticed that it's not really about what drives get met, like whether you feed the child, as it is about what kind of relationship the child has. I think John Bowlby's work on attachment was a kind of game changer, as was the work of W.R.D. Fairbairn, who argued that people need a connection more than they need a drive satisfied. And that was just very persuasive in the clinical community. Let me give you an example. If you're a strict Freudian and somebody's got a lot of compulsiveness in their personality, you tend to think about it as anal fixation. They're fixated on the developmental problem of control and lack of control and so forth. But when we started thinking more about what kind of family was the kid in, what were their full experiences, we found that the idea of a controlling family, or its opposite, a family that was so out of control that the child had to exert all the control, the whole issue of control and the environment had much more explanatory power than just what psychosexual phase the kid was fixated on, to use the old Freudian terms. And that has just continued to evolve. So that contemporary psychoanalysts are always thinking in relational terms, and always to the extent that they will think as much about what they're contributing to what's going on with the patient as what the patient is understanding them to be like. In other words, the Freudian idea is the patient's going to transfer stuff onto you, and you try to be fairly blank so that you can see what they're transferring. If they're saying, you're like my critical mother and you haven't said anything critical, then you're knowing that there's something important here. But in contemporary psychoanalytic work, most people agree that there's always something going on between both people, and the therapist has to look at what they're bringing to the dyad as well. So it's been a long, long evolution of that.
Yeah.
I think a lot of, you know, what people criticize about psychoanalysis is the medicalization of early Freudianism that was popular in the country circa 1950, and they know very little about contemporary psychoanalytic thinking.
Right. And the whole role of attachment theory seems to have had a huge impact across a, you know, I think for psychoanalysis, for Jungian analysis. I mean, a lot of people are looking through that lens now.
Yes, and I guess we can thank Bowlby for that, because he set up a research program. I mean, I think psychoanalysts have ourselves to blame in large part for the attacks that, you know, we aren't paying attention to evidence, because there are a lot of psychoanalytic ideas that could have been researched much better than they have been. But attachment theory really has, and it's a very valuable source of understanding.
Yeah. You refer to the neurotic hyphen borderline hyphen psychotic spectrum in a way that sort of surprised me, because I'm interested in the borderline and how that's in the middle, because I used to think of borderline, oh, that's the borderline between neurotic and psychotic. It's somebody who's almost psychotic but isn't. But then later it seemed like as the category of borderline became more fleshed out, it didn't seem like it was that anymore.
Yeah, and we had the problem, as we've always had in clinical writing, that people use terms in different ways. Some people did use the term borderline in the way you just described. But I think it was mostly Otto Kernberg's work in the early 1970s that sort of helped us focus around the idea of there being a kind of stable instability in some people. It wasn't that they were going to become schizophrenic, but they were somehow too disordered or too chaotic internally, too intense, had too much difficulty with regulating their emotions to be considered just neurotic. Mm-hmm. And they behaved differently in therapy. You know, at the neurotic range, somebody who feels that the therapist is critical sort of notices it and notices that the therapist hasn't really behaved that way and will come in and say, you know, you've been very supportive to me, but I keep having this fantasy that you're critical. Whereas the person in the borderline range, they're not psychotic, they're not deluded, they're not hallucinating, but they'll come in and they'll say, bitch, I'm sick of your criticizing me. And if you say to them, well, you know, is it possible that you're experiencing me as like your critical mother? They don't go to, well, gee, yeah, maybe I am transferring that. Where they go is, yeah, it's just my bad luck that I found a shrink exactly like my mother. And it was that phenomenon that therapists were trying to understand and work with. DSM as a sort of category, but that's not how it emerged.
I'm wondering if borderline is a bad word for it.
I think so.
You do think so?
I do think so. But, you know, we're stuck with a lot of bad words that sort of emerged over clinical experience.
Right. Yeah. I'd hate to have somebody tell me that I'm borderline. That's if you handed me the DSM and I had to find myself, and borderline was one of the...
You know, I know.
It sounds
like
terribly pejorative.
What?
Yeah, it also just feels very pejorative. Now, you make a distinction between primary and defense, and primary and secondary defense processes. What are you getting at there, and how do they play into your diagnostic schema?
Well, they are part of what people in my field tend to try to be formulating, either intuitively or specifically. about, you know, whether the patient tends to use fairly primitive ways of defending themselves against pain, anxiety, shame, humiliation, fear, and the negative feeling states.
When you say primitive, such as?
Let's say denial. It's okay. A pretty primitive defense. I mean, the way that, again, it's pretty arbitrary how we divide things, but the way that analysts tend to talk about primitive versus higher order defenses is that the more primitive ones distort reality in some important way.
Mm-hmm.
And they also tend to be unsure about the difference between what's inside and what's outside. So, you know, if I am afraid I'm gay and I imagine that, you know, the cashier where I'm checking out my clothing is wondering if I'm gay and critical of me because I look gay, I'm sort of confused about what's inside and what's outside. You know, is this my worry or mm-hmm. is she doing this to me?
Mm-hmm.
And we assume that, you know, in babies, there's a time before it's quite as clear to them what's inside and what's outside. We know now that they know a lot more than we used to think they did, but presumably when an infant is upset, they just feel a sort of global distress, and the world feels bad and the self feels bad. So being a little confused about that is part of primitive defenses, or distorting reality. It's denial is considered a more primitive defense. Denial is like, it didn't happen, or it's not true, as opposed to it happened and I prefer to forget it, which is repression, or it happened and I will just intellectualize about it but not feel it, which is intellectualization, or other ways that you kind of acknowledge reality but treat it somewhat defensively. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Now, part two of your book focuses on types of character organization, and years ago, I remember learning a distinction between neuroses on the one hand and character disorders on the other. Has that distinction gone away?
No, actually, it's very instantiated in up through DSM-4 in the difference between Axis 1 and Axis 2. That's really what that difference is. They call Axis 1 disorder rather than neurosis now. And they did that in 1980 because they were trying to get rid of psychoanalytic taint in the DSM. And what they call personality disorders is what used to be called character neuroses or character problems. But, you know, it's a useful discrimination to figure out whether a person is, has an obsessive-compulsive disorder versus are they obsessive-compulsive about everything? An obsessive-compulsive disorder might be that you have to do a particular ritual in one phase of your life. But if you're a completely ritualized person to the extent that you could be described as kind of a living machine, that's something more grave. So I think that distinction still does exist, and it's a kind of intuitively resonant distinction.
And it plays a strong role in your book. You have chapters on 9 different character organizations. I won't have you take us through all 9, but perhaps you could take us through 2 or 3 of your favorites to illustrate to illustrate the usefulness of understanding personality structure in the clinical practice process.
Let me see which ones I would pick. Let me say that in those chapters, I'm not implying that if you have a personality type, you have a personality disorder. I think we all have a type of personality or a combination of types of personality. So I could describe myself as depressive and hysterical, and I wouldn't be saying that I'm sick necessarily. But if my personality tendencies kept getting in my way or I was completely inflexible, then they would, you know, dimensionally move down toward a personality disorder. So I just want to say at the outset, to talk about these differences doesn't necessarily mean that you're saying people have a problem. They're just talking about observable differences in people's ways of defending against pain, of coping with life, of understanding the world, of regulating their emotion, and so forth.
Now, when you say you could describe yourself as depressive and hysterical is kind of a difficult word because it has different meanings. What is it that you mean when you say hysterical?
There is a kind of preoccupation that is not at all uncommon that got called hysterical in the old days and then histrionic later, which I think is an even worse word because it's more pathologizing. But it organizes experience very much along the lines of being sensitive to issues of gender and sexuality and power.
Hmm.
So that's what I mean. And Freud talked about it being symbolized in penis envy. I think he way overgeneralized about that. But I do think there are a lot of people who, because of their own history, inferred from life that, you know, one sex was the powerful sex and the other was the weak sex, and they kind of organize their thinking about how to deal with that. A lot of people who've been molested have that psychology. That's not the source of my own, but I did have a somewhat scary father, and so I am inclined to worry about whether I have enough power in a situation vis-a-vis a male.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a recurrent theme in my dreams, and I have to kind of watch that I don't over-experience things in that way. I mean, just an obsessive-compulsive person would be organized around issues of control, discontrol, a schizoid person around issues of closeness and distance, a paranoid person around trust, distrust, a psychopathic person around power or the lack of power. One of the ways that the DSM gets personality really wrong is they try to make I probably sound too confident there. In my view, this is is that they try to talk about personality in terms of present versus absent traits, but people aren't really organized around traits. In fact, if you see one trait, you often see the opposite trait. Every fanatically neat person I've ever known has a dirty drawer somewhere. Every person I've known who shrinks from relationship because they're kind of schizoid has moments of incredible connection with other people. This is something that Jung was really onto. And what differentiates people is it's not a trait at the end of that spectrum. It's the spectrum itself. It's being organized around that issue.
Mm-hmm.
So a paranoid person is organized around trust and distrust, and you'll see both. They'll be very distrustful, but some paranoid people will think that their cult leader is flawless. So they're like pathologically over-trusting in
mm-hmm.
some area. But the whole area of trust itself is the issue. Or narcissistic people who appear so inflated in their self-esteem also have, you know, very low self-esteem in some way. You can't say that they have a present versus absent trait of self-esteem. They use inflated self-esteem to defend against low self-esteem. And the whole issue of managing their self-esteem is what organizes them.
I love that dynamic that you've just painted for us.
Well, thank you. I'm not the only one who thinks that way. that is sort of essential to a psychoanalytic understanding of people, that they don't, I mean, there are traits in people, and there's a huge psychological literature on the big five traits, which are very reliable and valid, but they're not clinically very relevant. When I sit with people, I don't tend to think about those traits of agreeableness and conscientiousness and so forth. I'm thinking, What is their preoccupation here? What do they understand the world to be about? How are they experiencing the relationship with me? Are they organized around the fact that I'm a woman? Are they organized around the fact that I have power? Are they organized around the fact that I might impinge on them? Are they afraid I might abandon them? Those are different kinds of personality orientations.
Mm-hmm. And I can see how those would, in fact, structure the clinical process, how you will relate to them.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. With paranoid patients, there are a lot of people who have a pretty significant paranoid streak who will never be psychotic, or maybe at some point they had a breakdown, but they've been non-psychotic for years, but they have a significant paranoid streak. And if you know that about somebody that you're with, you know that they are very vulnerable to the experience of humiliation and attack. So you tend not to be trying to give them information about themselves the way you might to somebody who's hungry for your ideas about them, because they'll experience it as a humiliating, if they think you're right, it's a humiliation that they didn't know this, and they may very well experience it as an attack on them. So the literature about working with paranoid people often mentions that the therapist should be quite self-disclosing, because that kind of evens the playing field. You know, if my patient comes in and let's say he's a paranoid person and he's all critical of himself for something, let's say he says, oh, I lost it with my teenage daughter. You know, instead of just exploring that, which makes him feel even more humiliated because he's going to have to tell you all the details, it's probably more helpful to him to get safe in the first place to explore the details if he says something like, oh, tell me about it. When my kids were that age, I wanted to strangle them twice a day. What happened? Now, you wouldn't do that with most other types of personality. You wouldn't have to.
Boy, that self-disclosure really flies in the face of the image that most people would have about psychoanalysis, psychoanalysts, of being the blank screen.
Yes, and, you know, first of all, I always thought that that was a perversion of Freudian ideas. Freud didn't act like that himself. It was, people started emphasizing the blank screen when they were trying to make psychoanalysis a medical specialty that they could, you know, explicate the technique. But secondly, to the extent that that became like the image of classical analysis, it has certainly changed. The relational movement in psychoanalysis has pretty much wiped out the idea of the completely sanitary sort of or sanitized idea of being blank.
I don't know if the word's gotten out yet.
Maybe not, but there's a huge literature on self-disclosure.
Yeah, yeah. That's, well, I think my listeners will feel heartened by that knowledge. Hey, to switch focus just a bit, you mentioned penis envy. I see that one of your specializations has been in the integration of feminist theory and psychoanalytic knowledge, and perhaps you can give us an overview of that, especially since I recall that it was feminists who were particularly upset with psychoanalytic theory.
Yeah, well, I don't think you can be a woman of my age and be ambitious and not be a feminist. It would be very unusual, because when I came up, I'm 68, the voice of authority was always male, and there were very few examples of women living full, rich lives in which they both worked and had a domestic role. And as I remember what the sort of mindless sexism of the era that I went to high school with, it's kind of appalling in retrospect. So, of course, I'm a feminist, like almost every other ambitious woman my age. But I understood what the objections were to psychoanalysis. I think Freud was wrong in several ways about women. But on the other hand, I didn't think he was toxic in the way that some of them felt. I suspected that many of the women, such as Kate Millett, for example, who really went on the attack towards psychoanalysis, had very bad analysts or psychiatrists that had tried to tell them that they should be happy living in the suburbs and having 2.5 kids, and that any unhappiness with that meant that they had something horrible called penis envy, which is a very different way than I experienced Freud's comments on it. My experience of his comments on it were, well, yeah, of course, one sex has the power, and the other one notices that they also have a penis, and of course, you know, that envy of the power of the sex that's running the world mm-hmm. could be symbolized that way. And in his actual behavior, Freud did more to encourage women to be fully equal partners in a profession than any other profession I knew of. I mean, he encouraged his daughter into it. He invited women into his little in-group at a certain point. In psychoanalysis, there are many very important women, and have been since at least the 1930s, who were not just practitioners, but were major theorists.
Mm-hmm.
And Freud certainly supported that. So I always felt that it was an oversimplification to tar all psychoanalysis and all of Freud's ideas with the same brush of his having misunderstood some things about women.
Have you drawn any fire yourself for that, taking that position?
Not that I know about. I suspect at time in the early 70s when there was an awful lot of controversy within the feminist community, that there were feminists at that time that thought that, you know, I was sleeping with the enemy to say anything good about psychoanalysis. But I think most female analysts of roughly my era would describe themselves as feminists and always did. Mm-hmm. And there have been major feminist theorists. Nancy Chowdhury comes to mind, who have really contributed a lot both to psychoanalysis and to the larger culture.
Well, as we start to wind down here, I wonder if there are any final points that you'd like to make.
Well, I guess the reason that you were urged to interview me is the success of a book that has surprised me, actually, in its success, that I originally wrote because my students got sick of hearing me complain that there should be a book like this. And I suppose one thing we haven't talked about is I wasn't entirely surprised that the book did well in the United States, because I knew there was a need for it. And I knew that I wrote fairly well, which is not that common in the psychoanalytic tradition, I have to say.
Yeah, really.
In it. But what has completely floored me is the international reception. It's in 15 languages now and some other languages informally. And I get invited all over the world, and all over the world people recognize these personality differences. And even though they say that their own culture is somewhat different and that the personality types distribute differently, they resonate to this. So I guess, you know, I've been sort of emboldened by this and have been trying to put pressure on my own field, namely psychology, to look more at personality variables than at these randomized controlled trials that target a particular symptom. Because I think there's just much more value for psychotherapy in trying to understand the person you're talking to than in figuring out, you know, what criteria for this particular disorder are present or absent.
Well, I have to say that I really wish that your book had been around when I was in a PhD clinical program at the University of Michigan, which was very psychoanalytic at the time. I don't know if it still is or not. And the book that we read, I went into this program sort of naively, and the book that we were given was by Otto Finichel. I can't remember the exact title. Oh,
yeah.
A totally impenetrable and pathologizing tome.
Yeah.
That just really turned me off in a major way. If I had been given your book instead, oh, it would have been so much better, an introduction.
Well, that's very kind of you, though I do worry that, you know, over time, what I might say in a perfectly egalitarian way may be read with a tinge of pathologization later, because words tend to shift. You know, like the word retarded was originally thought a much better word than, you know, lunatic or idiot, and then it got changed to developmentally disabled or challenged, and we keep changing the terms of things. I suspect, from what I know about Otto Fenichel, he actually was a very humane, egalitarian, loving person, not particularly pathologizing in his actual practice, but the words were absolutely impenetrable by the time I was assigned that book, and it sounded very much like the doctor looking at all the rest of us and saying that we were sick. I'm not sure that was the tone in which it was written. So I do worry that no matter how careful I am to say about my own writing that, listen, I'm one of the people I'm writing about, I worry that in some future era it will sound not just quaint, but hostile.
Well, it's certainly very well tuned for this era. And so I want to encourage students out there or others who are interested in learning more about a contemporary psychoanalytic perspective to read this book. So,
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Nancy McWilliams, I want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, my thanks go out to listener and therapist Philip Brooks for recommending this interview with Dr. Nancy McWilliams. I really appreciate her combination of expertise and humility and the down-to-earth nature of her presentation. I also appreciate her willingness to engage in appropriate self-disclosure, which she illustrated in this interview, especially in her observation about her own personality structure and that it might tend a bit toward the depressive and hysteric. Her explanation of the meaning of hysterical was enlightening to me, and I'm sure to many listeners as well. She certainly has exploded the stereotypic myth of the psychoanalyst as a blank screen, bringing us up to date with contemporary psychoanalytic therapy practice. As you heard me say, I wish her book on psychoanalytic diagnosis had been my first exposure rather than Otto Fenichel's 1945 Psychoanalytic Theory of Neuroses. It was dated then. Nancy's book is the epitome of clarity, and I recommend it to all who wish to better understand psychodynamic personality theory. As always, you can use the Amazon widget on our site should you decide to order it, and a few pennies will fall into our tin cup.
Like what you hear? Show your appreciation by making a donation to keep this life-changing podcast up and running. Simply go to the Shrink Wrap Radio website and click on the big green donate button and show Dr. Dave some love.
Actually, it's no longer the big green donate button. It's now the big multicolored support button in the right-hand sidebar. At any rate, thanks to brother-in-law Mike West for that call to action. As most of you know, we do have an app for listening to the most recent 75 episodes of Shrink Wrap Radio on your iDevice or Android device. You'll find full details about that under the Apps tab on our site. However, I'm noticing a little glitch since updating my iPhone 5S to 7.0.3, and I thought I should pass it along in case any of you are experiencing similar difficulties. The app actually contains not only Shrink Wrap Radio, but also a lot of other podcasts. Appropriately, the app is called Podcast Box because it is full of podcasts. You want to get Shrink Wrap Radio into your My Shows page. Of course you do. It's like making it your favorite so that you can always go straight to it. First, you go to the Categories page, and Shrink Wrap Radio is in the Education category. I found I had to swipe the screen to the left to get the list of podcasts to show up. and Shrink Wrap Radio is about 5 pages in before you'll see its icon. Clicking on the little plus sign in the icon puts it on your My Shows page. I find I initially get a blank screen when I go to My Shows, but swiping to the left, or maybe it's to the right, I'm not sure which, fixes that and Shrink Wrap Radio shows up. Podcast Box is made by Libsyn.com, and they assure me that they will fix that in an upcoming release. They better. I'm paying $20 a month to make that app available to you. Speaking of the education category, if you go into the iTunes store, you'll find that Shrink Wrap Radio is in the higher education category. iTunes on my computer has been corrupted for some time, such that it would not let me see the education podcast category in iTunes. So I finally had to take my computer to the Genius Bar at my local Apple store, and they were able to fix that for me. Well, I'm happy to report that after all these years, Shrink Wrap Radio continues to get good billing there. At this moment, we're listed as number 5 in the top higher education podcasts, and the icon shows up in the What's Hot category. Yay! Pretty amazing, given that there are probably more than 100,000 podcasts out there. I don't have any new transcripts to announce, but I know there are one or two in process. If you'd like to transcribe one of your favorite interviews, first take a look at the transcripts page to see if it's already been done or in process. If you don't find it there, it means it's up for grabs. Then send me an email letting me know you'd like to take it on. Finally, I have to say I was surprised not to have received any comment on last week's show on the impact of internet pornography on adolescent brains. I really thought that one would stimulate some discussion. Okay, let's hear some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from a listener in faraway Tehran. I'm going to keep this one anonymous because I wouldn't want to cause any political fallout. This Iranian person writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, thank you so much for your podcasts. Very interesting and informative. In fact, I've been interested in the Jungian approach due to your podcasts. I would like to suggest that you have an interview with an expert in analyzing the relationship between Carl Jung and Sabina and the nature of their love relationship. Best regards." When I told this listener I was thrilled to have a listener in Tehran, they wrote back to say, "I have many listeners there. So if any of you are in Tehran listening, I send you greetings from one American who feels affection for the Iranian people." Now, of course, this listener is inquiring about the relationship between Carl Jung and his patient, Sabina Spielrein, who went on to become a very noteworthy Jungian analyst herself, specializing in working with children. Now, in 2012, David Cronenberg made a major film called A Dangerous Method, and he portrayed them as having a romantic relationship, a sexual relationship. But in fact, we do not have solid evidence to that effect. And I did interview a Jungian analyst about that film and about their relationship, Dr. John Beebe, and that's in Shrink Wrap Radio episode number 299. So anybody who's interested should go back and listen to that one. I also posted a blog post in my Psychology Today blog that I was doing at that time, and I titled the post, "A Dangerous Film?" And that was on February 18, 2012. You can find it by Googling Psychology Today, The Happiness Dispatch, which was the name of my blog, and you should find it that way. Now, you might recall that in my previous episode, I read an email from Jason, who was pretty sure he was going to attend a holotropic breathwork workshop with Stan Groff in Seattle, partly as a result of what he heard on my interview with Monica Wickman on that topic. Well, I received the following note from Jason just today about that experience. And he writes, "Hello, David. In short, the holotropic breathwork was pretty amazing. I had a rather rich, powerful experience, which is difficult to sum up here in a few sentences. I'm sure I'll be unpacking the experience for some time. I'm happy to share with you a post-breathwork write-up I wrote the day after the workshop that details my experience. If you have the time, I'd be interested to hear what your own experience was of doing something similar in your men's group, if you're open to that. Hope all is well for you in these days of seasonal change." Well, as you heard, Jason included 4 pages of notes that he had written after returning from the workshop. And they are probably too much to read here, but suffice it to say that he had a very powerful experience finding himself in at least 3 different bodies and lifetimes. Jason, thanks for sharing your adventure with me, and I applaud your courage for attending the workshop and getting as deeply into the process as you did. And as for the breathwork experience that I had in my men's group, it was very, very brief, and I did not spend enough time with it or go so deeply as to have had the kind of experience that you had. That will have to wait until such a time as I actually attend one of Stan's workshops. I'm not sure if I already remarked how surprised I am to not have received more comments about my interview with Gary Wilson on the effect of internet pornography on young men. However, here's one email that I did receive on that topic, and it comes from listener Jane, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I was listening to the interview with Gary Wilson on my way home from rehearsal tonight and had a thought about women and their reaction to pornography. I'm not surprised that women don't really find it interesting. What I would propose is that what women do find interesting are novels in the romance genre instead. If we're talking about pornography as creating unrealistic expectations in men as to the nature of sexual encounters, my impression is that women get similar unrealistic expectations from reading about fantasy romance. I have absolutely no real evidence to back this up, but it is an impression based upon casual observation on my part, just an idea. I should explain that I'm not a psychologist and have no formal psychological training, although I find human behavior quite fascinating. I did take psychology in college, and it was by far the most incredibly boring class I took. It was all statistics. And I find statistics boring. I am, however, a chemist, and I keep up with recent scientific advances in all scientific fields, and I have enjoyed your podcast a lot. I have learned quite a bit from your guests and the discussions you have with them. I've been listening for a while, and I will be making a contribution soon. I have returned to school this time to study music, one of those midlife career changes, and finances are not always what I would like them to be. I do need to mention one other thing. I went on a trip to Europe this past summer with the art department from school, and we went to Greece and Venice. This past summer was the biennial art show in Venice, and one of the highlights of the trip was to visit this exhibition. Imagine my delight in walking into the main exhibition hall at the site and seeing the Red Book displayed there in front of me. I had learned a lot of it from your podcast, and I was deeply impressed with the artwork in it. The exhibition included not only the book in the appropriate protective case, but also the watercolor copies of Jung's artwork that were made for the recently published edition of the Red Book. Jung was quite the artist. It has inspired me to get some of his books and do some reading, which will take some time with all of my other studies. Thank you for your hard work and your willingness to share your knowledge with the rest of us." And that's from Jane. Well, Jane, I appreciate your taking time to write and your observations about that female-oriented fiction that has sometimes been referred to as bodice rippers. And I think I would agree with you about your observations there. And Also got a kick out of your originally being turned off to psychology because there was so much emphasis on statistics. And that's interesting given that you're a chemist and therefore of scientific turn of mind, and I would think maybe a mathematical turn of mind as well. So I'm glad that you got to go to that exhibition on the, Jung and the Red Book, and that you were as impressed by it as you were, and that you had some knowledge of what it was all about as a result of listening to this show. So I hope you will continue to do so. And with that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. As always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on my message phone at 206-350-9918. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Nancy McWilliams, for sharing her insights into diagnostics and the psychodynamic understanding of personality structure. On the next episode, I will be speaking again with noted Jungian analyst and author Dr. James Hollis about his latest book, Hauntings, Dispelling the Ghosts Who Run Our Lives. It's a beautifully written book, and we're privileged to have someone of his stature and wisdom on the show. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.